Hey team, welcome back to the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with Nick Abusi, and today we are going to be discussing everything clinical decision making. Now, before we jump into this awesome topic, Nick, this isn't your first time on this podcast, and our listeners probably have heard about you. If they haven't, well, they're missing out. But do you want to give a bit of an introduction into yourself and what you do before we jump in?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. So I'm Nick. I'm from Australia. I'm a critical care paramedic. I work for a jurisdictional ambulance service. But in the last few years, I've spent a lot more time playing in the private sector. So I run a business called Explorer Medicine. We do a lot of work in remote and challenging environments. And I do some event medicine, and I also run a platform called The Shift Extension, which is another podcast as well, and we do a few other bits and pieces. So that's me. It keeps me nice and busy, but it's also very fulfilling.
Wow. Well, I feel like we've definitely got the best person for this particular topic today. So thank you so much for carving some time out of your day, Nick, to chat to us about this, because clinical decision making skills underpin everything that we do, and it's crucial. Even if we were in the private sector or with a jurisdictional ambulance service, it's required as a key component of what we do as a paramedic. So Nick, I'd love to start by getting a bit of an introduction into clinical decision making, why it's important, so that we can build on from there.
Now, it's a great topic, and I think we could spend 45 minutes talking about one tiny slither of the topic, but we'll just try and keep it on track and see if we can find some gems for the audience. So I think let's start off by saying, well, I'm going to ask you a question, Alex.
Go for it.
What's the most important piece of equipment in your toolkit?
I'd like to say my brain, but...
Yes, 100%. It's your brain. And that's the thing about paramedics, especially when you're junior and even when you get into your career, you get so excited about toys. I call it paramedic new toy syndrome, where we get a new piece of kit and we want to play with it, right? It's like Christmas. You open up a truck or whatever your parents got you, and you want to play with it and do nothing else. It's the same when you're an adult and same when you're a paramedic. Now, we love to, you know, put airways in people and cannulate and give drugs, and sometimes we value our worth based on how broad our scope of practice is. However, the most important tool is what you do with what's between your ears, a little mushy thing called your brain, and that's the most important thing for us to develop. Now, I could teach a monkey how to intubate someone. I can't teach a monkey how to think and appraise the information and make decisions about what to do with what's in front of them. And that is what clinical decision-making is. It's about making sense of the information that's in front of you and deciding what you need to do with it, because we have patients who come to us, who engage us because they have a problem and they want us to provide them a solution to their problem. And in order to create that solution or determine what is the best solution for our patient, we need to be able to make sense of the information in front of us at the time. Now, decision making suggests that we need to do something with it. But I think sometimes, and what we'll talk about tonight is, sometimes we don't need to do things. Sometimes it's better for us to sit on our hands and watch and wait and consider new things rather than dive into a diagnosis or dive into a treatment. But we'll delve into that rabbit hole a little bit more during our conversation.
That's amazing. Thanks, Nick. You've given us a really great introduction into what clinical decision making is and how important our brain is in that process. decision-making, as you said, is making sense of the information in front of you and deciding what you need to do with it. And it sounds a lot like making an informed decision. So what does an informed decision actually mean? And how do we actually make sense of the information that's in front of us?
So an informed decision, or a decision, occurs when we have all the information and then we need to make sense of it. So let's start off by understanding what is it that we do. And when we're junior, when we're new to paramedicine, and what is taught to us really at university is pattern recognition, right? Where we take pieces of information that fit a pattern that lead to a specific diagnosis. So let's use the example of acute coronary syndrome. The pattern is middle age, generally male, central heavy crushing chest pain, sweating, nausea, shortness of breath, high blood pressure, plus or minus ECG changes, right? That is the pattern to it. So when we get those bits of information, when they're present in front of us, then we draw the conclusion that it is acute coronary syndrome. Now, we gather that information through a number of means. One of it is by asking questions of our patients. There's that subjective information, that history gathering. Some of it's objective, where we're looking at the patient's vital signs, we're looking at their ECG, we're looking at their surroundings, seeing that they live in a house and there's cigarette butts and there's bad food in the fridge and they're a little overweight and they've got a number of any hypertensive medications and medications for the cholesterol and diabetes. So we're constantly gathering all this information that helps us create a pattern. Now, some of that information is important and some of it isn't important. And that's another aspect of decision making, is what we're doing is we're trying to determine what is important and what isn't. So we're taking on some information and keeping it, and we're taking on some and then deciding to discard it. And that's a process called hypothetico-deductive reasoning. Now, you think about the questions you ask someone with chest pain. You might say to them, hey, do you have chest pain? And they say, yes, I do. You know, great. Now, you're going to determine that patient has chest pain, so it can be a number of differential diagnoses, right? So you're going to rattle them off in your head. So it could be the pattern of ACS. It could be the pattern of pneumothorax. It could be the pattern of it's been stabbed in the chest. So, well, how do I narrow down my list? I'm going to ask another question. So you might ask, or you might do another exam, like, do you have a knife in your chest? Have you been stabbed? And they go, no, I haven't been stabbed, sir. And they go, well, it's probably not a stab wound that's causing your chest pain. And you can cut that off the list. And then over time, you wither down your potential patterns or your potential problems until you find something that you think is going on. And then you make a decision to say, hey, that's my impression of the patient. Now, there's something different between an impression and a diagnosis, but we'll talk about that during our chat.
Now, that's awesome, Nick. However, you used, is it hypothetico deduction? What on earth does that mean?
Hypothetico deductive reasoning. The way I remember it is hypo, it's a hypothesis, deductive, you're deducing things, you're taking things away, and reasoning, you're making sense of it.
Awesome.
It took me 8 years to realize that I was actually doing that.
I mean,
I was like, oh, is that what I'm doing? Oh, great.
It's interesting because that's going to be sort of what we talk about on this podcast is, you know, we all, you know, whether or not you're a student or and you're on placement, you're doing these things, or whether or not you're a new paramedic or a seasoned paramedic, and you start doing these things, you start asking patient questions, you start, you know, starting to make these sort of decisions, but sometimes you don't understand why you're doing what you're doing. And I guess today, like you said, it took you 8 years to realize that's what you're doing. And I guess hopefully today we're going to bring some of that sort of, I guess, that theory basis in to describe what it is, what it is that we're actually doing. Now, I guess with clinical decision making, there is always room for error and bias to crop up. When I sat in on one of your presentations a few years back, I think I was still a student actually, I heard you talk about something called System 1 and System 2 thinking and how that has a role to play within our clinical decision making and how bias can creep up in certain aspects of those systems. And it's something that really has stuck with me when I think about sort of clinical decision making and improving practice. So I'd really love for you to chat about system one, system two thinking, potentially some bias in there as well, and how we can develop our clinical decision making and get it better or develop it better with these concepts in mind.
Yeah, great. So you're talking about system one and system two thinking, which are two different kind of ways in which we process information within our environment. Now, what I spoke about earlier with this hypothetico-deductive reasoning and asking a bunch of questions and appraising our situation and the environment for which we find our patient, that's kind of system two thinking. So we'll start off with that. System two is very analytical and it's slow. And the idea is it allows you to slowly and methodically make sense of the information that's in front of you without jumping to conclusions. So it's a really good process for making accurate decisions. It's just really slow. It's not very efficient. It doesn't work for every situation. And every situation requires a decision, right? So if someone's running at me with a knife or there's a tiger in my bedroom, right, I can't see them going, there's a tiger. Maybe it's hungry. Maybe I should move. Isn't hungry. Like, it's just not going to work. So in order for me to survive and also to be able to make sense of information in a more efficient manner when I'm overloaded with information, I need a different system. And that system is called system one thinking. It's great because it's fast and I can appraise information quickly and act on it. So it's great for, say, a bleeding patient. So you come across a patient, there's blood spurting everywhere, and I need to be able to quickly recognize that I need to do something about that. And I make it that decision and I'll start, put a tourniquet on, apply pressure, pack the wound. It needs to happen quick and fast. The problem with system one is that it's prone to bias. It's not very reliable. It's not very accurate. So as paramedics, it's about balancing these two different types of thinking, being aware that we do them. And sometimes when we have a lot of stuff going on, we can actually switch between the two different systems and the way we approach a job. And it's a skill that I think is very much worthwhile trying to develop, because it'll help you make better decisions, but it'll also help you crack on when you need to in those situations where the patient needs some immediate cares.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I find every single time you talk about sort of system one, system two thinking, I find it really intriguing and I always want to know more about how it applies to paramedicine. What I've found over the past few years is it's really interesting that when you're a student or when you're a brand new paramedic and you're working with someone who's quite seasoned and they're really good at their job, you'll talk to them and, or you'll watch them, should I say, and they'll do something and they'll do it with such ease. They'll talk to someone at the same time, asking them questions. They look like they're super cool, calm, collected, got everything under control. And when you try and do it as a brand new paramedic or as a student, it takes so much of your bandwidth to focus on what you're doing. And I think sometimes when we do become a bit more seasoned and when these thoughts or these skills and thought processes become more automatic, we forget that our newer version of ourselves, you know, back in the day when we were a student or a brand new paramedic, that it would have taken us a lot longer to understand what it is we're actually doing and why we're asking those questions and why we've particularly stood by the side of the patient or why we set something up in a particular way because it makes all these things automatic. So I find it really intriguing how over time it just becomes second nature. And I find it can be quite difficult to really unpack that and actually teach that to other people.
I think you're right. I think, you know, a good example is say a cannula, right? When you first put in your first cannula, you have to be really, really cognizant of how you do it. Like, right, I need to put the tourniquet on. And then, okay, what's next? Alcohol wipe. Great. I can't touch it. Right. Which cannula? Well, I'm going to use. Right. Hold it this way, this angle into puncture flashback. Oh, you know what I mean? You have to think about it. Whereas after you do a few, you just put one in. whilst asking the patient a series of questions whilst looking at some vital signs, right? It becomes second nature. And that's why training is really important and good practice is important. Not practice, because practice, my grade four sports teacher said this to me, practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. If you do it the wrong way, it's not going to get any better, right? So this is why training is important, is it because it allows you to become more efficient with certain tasks to limit your bandwidth. So if I can put a cannula in without having to think about putting a cannula in, it frees up my bandwidth to be able to make decisions about other things. And it starts to shift that process from a system two to a system one thinking. So I think, yes, time will help. Training also helps. But there's other things you can do. I call them little plays. Have you heard of like a playbook?
Yeah, like playbooks for sport is all I've heard of.
I call them like plays in a playbook, right? We introduce these to some of our critical care trainees, is that you need to develop your playbook, right? And these are a series of steps that are reproducible across different types of patient presentations that allows you to quickly gain control of that situation and apply some good interventions without having to think about it too much whilst you gather some information. So a good example, let's use the example of a traumatic arrest, right? You're going to go to a traumatic arrest, you're going to do a physical exam, you're going to stop any external hemorrhages, pull the limbs to length, bind their pelvis, and decompress their chest, right? Or actually another really good example is, let's say you come across a multi-system trauma patient that's all bent up, a number of orthopedic injuries, they're moaning and groaning, they look terrible, and you're like, oh, this is a really sick patient, I don't know what to do. But there's some basic plays you can do, which is put them on oxygen, give them some intramuscular pain relief, get them some access, give them some of the sedation, and then pull them all to length and then start again, right? And it's a really simple process that kind of applies to a lot of your patients who you find in that situation. Now, there are some nuances to it. You can't just necessarily do cookbook medicine in that regard, but having these little processes that you've pre-thought out means that they almost start to shift towards becoming system one style processes, and it opens up your bandwidth and reduces the chances of you becoming cognitively overloaded or not being able to gather the information and make sense of it to then go and make good clinical decisions.
That's a really cool idea, actually. I really love the idea of that playbook sort of method. I guess not the like you were saying, not the cookbook method of medicine. However, like having those plays, being prepared for what might occur, I guess it takes away some of that stress that you may have going into a job, and that, like you said, having that perfect practice, making sure you're utilizing your training to really get used to what you may come across and troubleshoot some of the problems that you may have. So I'd love to pick your brain now, I guess, about bias. We've all heard about bias, and it's becoming a lot more apparent now. It is spoken about a lot more, I guess. But what is bias, and how can it creep into our assessment, our decision making, and how can we try and prevent it, I guess, prevent the negative bias?
Yeah, so bias is everywhere, and we are all prone to bias. It doesn't matter who you are or how good you think you are, you're going to be biased. I'm biased. Alex is biased. The London Hems is biased. We're all got our own biases based on a number of things. Our biases come from our own knowledge, our own previous experiences, our views of the world, how we've appraised previous situations, how hungry we are, how tired we are. Did I have a fight with a cat on the way to work this morning? Like, there's lots of things that can affect that and influence it. The best thing we can do is be aware of our biases, acknowledge them, and understand how they affect our clinical judgment. Now, if you want to consider a definition of cognitive bias, it's essentially where we deviate away from normal, rational judgment of our surroundings. So whereby we judge the information incorrectly or not how our peers might, or what we may not judge it in a reasonable fashion. So let's use the example of your 75-year-old patient who has COPD who rings you because they're short of breath, and we say they're anxious, right? Our bias is that people who are short of breath are anxious. Or another really common one is the 21-year-old female who's intoxicated, who's short of breath, and you say, oh, she's just anxious, because our bias is that 21-year-old females don't have significant medical conditions that cause them to be short of breath. Therefore, it must be this other thing. So, another one might be, you know, someone's called an ambulance, you know, five times for the same problem, and we're biased into thinking that they are wasting our time. Whereas another way to consider it or to look at it might be, maybe this person's problem so complex in that we haven't been able to provide a solution to them, despite them engaging with healthcare quite a number of times, which tells us that either their problem is complex and it needs a different approach, or we haven't gone about it the right way the first time, rather than seeing it through the lens of they're wasting our time. And, you know, that bias can be there for a number of reasons, but it can significantly change how we look after that patient or the patient's disposition and treatment plan.
Absolutely. And that's a, you know, really good point in terms of what we call like that availability heuristic. So like if you see that young person who's intoxicated, you're unlikely to think of them potentially having like maybe might be a cardiac event or a stroke or something like that. Versus, you know, if you have seen that before, you're more likely then to think, oh, well, you know, young people can, it might be rare, but it can happen. And you're not as likely to make those sort of decisions in the future. And I think, you know, we're all guilty of, you know, hitting bias at certain points in time. And it's really important to not sort of feed into it. How do you prevent that from creeping into your practice?
Well, I think you need to understand your own limitations. And I say this because I think paramedics are probably more prone to bias than other healthcare clinicians. Now, before people get upset by that, it's not meant to be a negative thing. It's just by the nature of how we operate and how we train. So generally, during your training, you'll go and you'll learn a number of conditions, and you'll learn how to assess those conditions and what's the pattern for those conditions. So for chest pain, you'll learn a number of differentials for chest pain, PEs, ACS, pleural effusion, pneumothorax, costochondritis, rib fracture. There's a few, right? So we'll go to our patient and we'll think of those 6 to 8 to 10 differentials for chest pain. And what sometimes happens is that we silo our patient into one of those differentials. So we'll take that information and we'll manipulate it, or maybe disregard some of the information that suggests that it's not one of those things, and maybe anchor on some information that suggests that it is. And we'll silo a patient into a diagnosis rather than consider that there's a lot of other things that can cause chest pain, for example, other than the diagnoses that I have learned in my training. And this is where I think we fall down as paramedics. I think we have created a culture whereby where we think we need to make a diagnosis, we're taught that we need to make a diagnosis, when at making a diagnosis with the knowledge, with the tools and the time that we have isn't necessarily achievable, right? We don't have CT machines, we don't have bloods, we don't have time, we don't have a fellowship of emergency medicine. We are getting better at getting patients' previous medical history and records, but we don't have that level of information to be able to make the same level of judgment as some of our colleagues in other areas of medicine. What I think paramedics need to do is accept this and go, I actually can't make accurate diagnoses, but what my role as a paramedic is to be able to determine what the patient needs next. We might give some pain relief, we might resuscitate the patient, we might splint fractures, do some interventions from a to resolve some of those immediate needs, but generally that's not more of our patients. Like 90% of our patients are primary healthcare patients or complex patients that don't have obvious things that need for us to intervene on. So what our role really is to take that information and decide where in the healthcare system does this patient need to go next, right? Do they need to go back to a GP? Do they need to go to an urgent care center? Do they need to go to an emergency department? Do they need some advice and then see how they go, and they need time and then an idea of where to go if certain things prop up? So really paramedics, their role is the first point of contact into the healthcare system. Right? People go, I've got a problem. I ring 000 or 911, or is it 999 in the UK?
Yeah.
999, because I have a health problem. I ring number, people come. Great. Or I go to the medic on the film set, or I go to the medic at the festival, or I go to the medic at the mine site, or I go to the medic on the research vessel. Whatever it is, wherever you are a paramedic, you are the first point of call and you are the access for that person into the healthcare system, the broader system. We are the navigators, not the diagnosticians.
Yeah, I definitely like that, because I think even throughout my practice, everyone says you're not making that a diagnosis. It's a working impression, or what are you doing next, pretty much. And we're quite supported over here in the UK to make sort of a lot more referrals for patients and get them into all different places in terms of the healthcare system, which is a really nice way of you suggesting and explaining how we are that point of call and realizing what it is next that patient needs. Where do they fit into that system? I really like that. I think that's a really important thing to consider, particularly, like you said, we are limited. And I think that's really important, that I don't think a lot of people have probably considered before.
I think that's something we need to change in the culture of our education of, you know, how many undifferentiated patients did you look after in scenarios at university?
Not really.
No,
yeah,
right.
We literally did.
Do any?
No, and literally, and I think even in terms of with your cardiac arrest, you have patients that just come back to life, and you've got to manage a ROSC. Yeah. You know, that's right. No one does the what if you run into the grey, which is where we sit a lot of the time.
And this isn't a dig at, you know, education institutions around the world. Like the pattern recognition stuff and the stuff they do at the moment is very, very important. And we need clinicians who are able to manage those serious and life-threatening conditions in a timely and appropriate way and make good decisions when it counts. Because if we don't, then we can have deleterious patient outcomes. But they don't represent the entirety of the patient demographic that paramedics see. So there's some maturity that needs to happen there. And this is where your clinical decision-making is really where you're making money. You know, the patient with the femur hanging out, it's pretty obvious the femur is broken. I know what I need to do, right? Betty with the weird abdo pain, who's 75, who's, you know, a bit vague and not herself, that is challenging. That's where you're making money.
Absolutely. So we've spoken about sort of what clinical decision making sort of is, how to make an informed decision, or what is an informed decision. We've spoken a little bit about sort of that system one, system two thinking, and how we want to develop ourselves into building as much sort of system one thinking as possible. And we want to equally recognize our limits and avoid as much bias into our practice as we can. So we've done a lot more of that sort of theoretical basis behind it and spoken about these concepts. But now I want to pick your brain about how do we actually or practically improve our clinical decision-making skills so that we become a better clinician?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. I think there's a few things you can do. I'll start off by saying you have to change your perception of what a right or wrong decision is. Something I see and something I'm guilty of is that you judge a decision firstly based on information that you may not have had at the time. So let's say you thought a patient was hyperkalemic and they weren't, and you're like, oh, I got it wrong, but you didn't have a gas that you could have done to make that decision, right? And you say it was the wrong decision. Or any other myriad of decisions that you make, you're saying they're right or they're wrong. What I think we need to be doing instead is asking ourselves, did I make a reasonable decision with the information that I had available to me at that time? And even think of a group of your peers. If five people were sitting here and you explained the decision you made based on that information that you had, and they all came to the conclusion that it was reasonable, then that's great. That's fine. We need to get away from this right or wrong because it's too ambiguous. And it happens. Like, you get patients who you're like, oh, it's definitely this, and it isn't. And then the next week it is, and you can't pick it because patients don't read textbooks, funnily enough. So I think changing that that perception of the quality of your decision making is really important. Now, you mentioned the what ifs. We never really go in these what if scenarios. But I think there's a really good opportunity to improve your decision-making by simply taking some of the patient interactions you have, reflecting on them, and start throwing some what-ifs in there. So let's use the example of a cardiac arrest. You turn up there in VF, you shock them a bunch of times, you do a little bit of CPR, then you get ROSC, they sit up, you give them a crisp high five, and off to hospital they go. Great. Well done. Everyone's happy. Now, what if that patient stayed in VF and you've done 35 minutes? What if that patient got ROSC and then rearrested and got ROSC and then rearrested and got ROSC and then rearrested? What if that you turned up, that patient was in VF, but they had a terminal illness and the wife's like, please don't do anything. He's dying of cancer. So if you start to build in these hypothetical scenarios, you can start to think about, well, how would I make a decision in that setting? What other information would I want? Who else could I call upon? What other tools could I use to make a reasonable decision? And you start to create these almost scenarios in your head, or these experiences in your head, that can be valuable to you when you come across them in your practice. So rather than waiting for that refractory VF cardiac arrest or waiting for that terminal cancer patient that's had a witnessed arrest in front of the family, start to throw in some what-ifs into your existing experience, and you can create some awesome learning for yourself. I used to keep a A4 notepad. I should still do it. I don't. I'm like a bit lazy sometimes. But you can start to like just write down what you went for the day, right? Write down, I went to a patient with a broken femur. Great. And then you can put down three what-if scenarios, right? Or two or one, depends how much time you have. So let's say your patient's broken their femur. What if scenario one is they're allergic to morphine, fentanyl, and ketamine? Now what? Your next what-if scenario is you don't have a traction splint. How can you improvise it? And your next what-if scenario is they have a fracture in their tib fib as well. So you may not want to put a traction device on. Let's call it those three things. And then you can start thinking about, well, how would I make decisions in those scenarios? I think that's a really good place to start.
That's really awesome. I really like that. And I like how what you've mentioned there as well is to change the scenario. So, for example, if you don't have that traction splint, for example, that's great for you, you know, if you're looking at being a medic in sort of the wilderness or, you know, not having access to certain things. So it's a really, I really like that. Actually, I think I might start doing that as well.
Do it.
I love stationery. So any excuse to go and buy another notebook, yes. Honestly.
Yeah, do it.
But it's really interesting because what you mentioned there in terms of, you know, that right versus wrong decision, have you made the right or wrong decision and moving away from that? It's really interesting because, you know, I think we see it a lot. I don't know if it's, you know, worldwide, but, you know, you do see people that will critique you about a decision you made for a patient. And, you know, you hear other paramedics sort of talk about that and what they would do differently. But if you're on scene, how do you sort of diplomatically, and I use that word for a reason, challenge someone's sort of approach or their decision making? You know, you could be a student with a mentor, you could be two paramedics working together, which can be a challenge. Like, how do you approach that? What would be your advice?
Yeah, that's good. There's three things I'll say. So a good decision now is better than a perfect decision later, right? And pick your battles. So, you know, you may not agree with the other person, but the first thing you should consider is there a significant patient safety issue here, right? So if we're arguing over should we give this patient morphine or fentanyl for their pain, is that a problem? No. It's just a different way to skin a cat. And the thing is, what we do is as much of an art as it is a science. So the way I treat a pain might be different to two other paramedics. But if we achieve the right outcome, it's safe and it's reasonable, then that's fine. And it's something we do a lot with the critical care paramedics is they come into the program and they go, well, how do I treat this condition? And you're like, well, depends. I treat it this way. And then they go with the next person and they're like, oh, no, you do it this way. And they're like, what? So a good example is, you know, when's the threshold to cardiovert a SVT patient, right? And some people are aggressive and some people like sit on their hands. They're both reasonable, but they're two different ways to do it. And they struggle with this idea that, what do you mean there's different ways to skin a cat? I thought there's just a way, but no, there isn't. There is different ways. So if you come across a situation where you may not agree with the pathway that we're going down, you have to ask yourself, well, is there a patient safety issue here? Yes or no? Is it reasonable? Yes. Do I need to bring it up now? Maybe, you know, can we crack on and talk about it later? Sure. Right. You know, there's times to interject, and it's really important that we allow people to interject, because that's, we've learned from various case studies, you know, anyone that's familiar with Elaine Bromley will attest to this, that not speaking up is a bad thing. It's bad for patients. So we need to have that culture of being able to speak up. But I think also sometimes, and what I've found is we end up in this kind of vortex of we're running around and we lose that kind of forward momentum of a job because we're arguing, not arguing, but having a discussion about something. Whereas we just need to go, we're doing this, guys. We can talk about it later, right? And that's something, you know, sometimes I come across. And it's not a bad thing. It's good. Like, I want people to question my judgment. I want the first year, first day student to feel empowered to ask me, is that reasonable? Is that right? Is there a different way to do it? That's great. We need that culture. But, you know, sometimes good plan is better than a perfect plan. And, you know, there's different ways to skin a cat. Now, how do I bring that up after the fact in a diplomatic sense? Now, I like to use an approach. Have you heard of the differences between, say, feedback and a debrief? Have you heard that idea?
Not necessarily, no, but I'm trying to just think of the differences between the two.
So essentially, like, you think of feedback, giving someone feedback is essentially saying to them, well, highlighting the difference between what you saw and the standard that's accepted. So it might be your pain relief was too slow, your cannula was crap, your, you know, you didn't give someone aspirin, right? Whereas a debrief is a way of, you know, using more of a question style model and using coming from a position of intrigue to look at understanding the why behind things and getting that other person to kind of form their own conclusions. So it might be like, oh, why didn't you give this patient aspirin? Why was that cannula troubling you? Why did it take longer than normal? So I think if you want to have these conversations, rather than coming it from a position of you did or didn't do this, like statements, you need to come from it from a position of intrigue and be intrigued about why someone's doing something. And I think you'll get a whole lot less hostility that way because people put their guard up. If I come up to you and say, you didn't give someone aspirin, that's bad, you're going to get your guard up. And we're not going to have a conversation that's constructive any way, shape or form. But if I come to you and say, Alex, I'm really curious, why didn't you give that patient aspirin? And you might say, oh, they have got a peptic ulcer. You're like, oh, sorry, I didn't hear that. I was outside doing something else. Or you might say, oh, flip, I forgot aspirin. Thanks for highlighting that. I'm going to go let the healthcare team know that we didn't give this chest pain patient aspirin. So it's far more constructive. It's good for the relationships. And I feel like there's better learning from all parties if we take it from a position of intrigue.
Absolutely. And I definitely feel from experience there too, it's also how you present yourself, that communication, that body language. Because if you come up to someone like, you know, why did you do this? But you're quite closed off and very like, you know, quite straightforward with your question and not quite that open. And like you said, that really intriguing way, then, you know, people will put their guard up, and that does happen. Like if just imagine it come to you and presented in two different ways, and it definitely makes a huge difference. So we have discussed quite a lot today. A lot, which is fantastic. I've learnt so many things, Nick, and I can't wait to go and buy some more stationery to
yes.
Honestly, that's exactly what I'm going to do with the rest of my day.
Is there Office Works in the UK?
There's not an Office Works, but they've got like similar stores, and honestly they bring me the same amount of joy. So
is there a Bunnings in the UK?
They've got like a B&Q version, but there's no barbecue at the front with the sausage sizzle. I know.
All right.
Terrible. They're missing something there.
Hey, listeners, you're missing out on one of life's true treasures.
A sausage sizzle at the front of your B&Qs would be, that's a missed opportunity right there.
It is.
So we've spoken a lot about clinical decision making, and it's been fantastic. Is there anything you feel like we've missed, or you want to sort of give a golden nugget to our listeners, and potentially even some further resources for them to go away and look at?
I think that you have to appreciate that clinical decision making is the most important skill you can develop, and it's not an easy skill to develop. You will continue to do so for the entirety of your career. There's no magic recipe. There's no textbook or CPG or guideline or whatever to make this simple or quick. It's something that you just need to go out and start to think about. No pun intended. So take your time. Think about your own biases. Think about how you make decisions. And just be really curious with yourself. Go get a notepad from UK Office Works and create some of those scenarios for yourself. I think, you know, sometimes we go, I need to go work for a really busy ambulance service so I can see lots of patients. And if I see lots of patients, then I'll be a good paramedic. But you can see the same patient 30 times. Doesn't mean you have 30 experiences. You've just had the one experience repeated 30 times, right? So you need to take each of those experiences and do something with it. Doing that is as important as having the experience in the first place. So you can be working in a really low tempo environment and still have some amazing learning outcomes from your patient cohort, even more sometimes than working in, say, a busy metropolitan area.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really love that. So Nick, where can our listeners find out more about you and what you're doing with everything to do with Explorer, Shift Extension, everything?
Yeah, so you can find us online, www.theshiftextension.org, or check out Explorer Medicine. Both those groups are on Instagram. If you're on Instagram, that's where we post most of our stuff. But also you can find me on LinkedIn. Feel free to add me. Send me a message. Happy to chat anytime. Looking forward to hearing from you.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Nick. I really appreciate you taking your time to come chat to us. Appreciate it.
No worries, Alex. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. If you've learned something, if you've enjoyed it, please give us a rating and a review. And please reach out to us on our social media and via email so that we can improve and also take on board some suggestions so that we can provide content that's right for you.